now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Next stop is getting the jogging, getting some pounding action.
Next stop,
fake knee.
And next stop is actually recording, albeit 36 hours late, a entire installment of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. I am Phil Lairness, and you heard discussing his road to recovery down under for a few months longer, Mujahideen, Dean Haglund. How's your knee doing? How are you doing?
Spectacular. The knee is phenomenal. What can I say? There's a daily yoga practice. There's chiropractors. There's people with needles sticking in there. There's physiotherapists. Everybody's having a good gander at the old new knee.
It's as if the marvels of modern science have come down under and everybody wants to take a poke.
That's right. What can be more fun? Poking at a knee.
So you were
in fact the chiropractor said.
Yeah,
said that one leg is actually shorter than the other because of all the gear that they put in there has actually lengthened the length of my leg.
Oh, well, that would I think wouldn't that potentially lead to hip problems?
Well, that's what the chiropractor is correcting. Believe it or not, finding the new center. What with this hardware of chrome, titanium, and polymers all jammed in there.
That feels like the difficult road. The easier road seems to just be to shave down your heel bone.
Yeah, you think shaving bone would be easier than the process I'm going through. But in fact, believe it or not, the process I'm going through is the easier one.
Now, speaking of processes that may or may not be easy, when you move to Motor City, Detroit, the city of brotherly love, the city by the bay,
yes.
Sin City,
City by the Bay.
Yeah. That's always been one of my favorite things, that, a couple of friends and I always do is like, whenever a city gets mentioned, we love using the wrong moniker for it. You know, like on a plane, it's so great. It annoys people so much. We are now descending upon Miami. And then you wait a beat and you go Beantown.
City of brotherly love.
So you've got to find a place there now. If memory serves, did the company, and when I say the company, I certainly don't mean the CIA as far as anyone knows, but did the company responsible for Patty's relocation actually help locate where you're living now?
Yes, there was a relocation specialist that was hired, but basically it was a real estate agent showing us around various spots, and we picked one just without, just measuring distance from office to where we wanted to be. So that's how we determined it here. So we have a real estate agent already in Michigan that's preparing the search so that when we get there, lo and behold, we'll be looking at places.
I am curious as to whether it will be easier or more difficult, this relocation.
Wow, that's a great question, because as exciting as Detroit's, Michael Bolton just did a documentary saying it's the greatest urban turnaround in American history. So real estate and construction and redevelopment is going on there like a crazy, and we're jumping in the middle of that. So it's hard to say if it's going to be easier or harder in that capacity. I think it may be just a little more culture shock, to say the least, particularly when we leave here in September. It'll be the end of winter in Australia, and we're arriving just for the beginning of winter in Michigan.
Yeah, a so whole, we're year, miss whole year without summer again, right?
yeah, that's always a tough one. You know, as opposed to the opposite, it's a whole year of summer. That's kind of easier to deal with, but the reverse, a bit more tricky.
Whole year of summer can be an entire year in Los Angeles, really. I mean, more or less. It can be, right? I mean, we've had some unbelievably hot winters before, and always at Christmas time it is. Now, let me dial back on something. Michael Bolton, the singer?
Yeah, Michael Bolton, the singer, has a documentary coming out called Detroit, and it's part of the Fathom.
Oh, my goodness. It's just another way for him to take a giant steaming dump on black cultural history.
Yeah, there's a lot of Motown history.
Oh, God. Because you know me, and there's nothing I like more than Motown, especially when it's sung by a feathery-haired white man. Okay.
Yeah, so take a look for that. May 15th, I think, in select theaters.
I watch all the Michael Bolton documentaries. His documentary about ethnic cleansing in Chechnya, anyway, all right.
My God.
Which, again, ethnic cleansing is the perfect way to describe his musical genre. Okay. This was not planned. This whole
not at all
tirade on Michael Bolton. I had no idea Michael Bolton was going to come up in conversation. And I think we're all glad at the end of this tax day here in the United States that it did. And what a whirlwind it's been. I apologize for this show being a couple days late. Been working around the clock creating deliverable materials for the Lady Killers. This has been a more than a month-long process at this point. Also having to do the taxes. I'm teaching extra acting classes because I've got a lot of bills to pay for because of the miraculous recovery of the Fuzz Aldrin, who, I kid you not, just crawled up onto my shoulder and is licking the microphone, ladies and gentlemen. So she is feeling good. She wants to be back in the mix with us again, Dean. But all that is my way of saying that we apologize for the delay. But next week, as early as next week, we may just have some dates. Certainly, I would think within a fortnight's time, we'll be able to announce some release dates for the Lady Killers.
Ooh. Won't that be exciting?
Won't that be? Now, I hate to bring the room down, but boy, I had prepared this show, and then when we knew we were going to postpone, it seemed like every day somebody said, nope, you got to open that file again because there's been another celebrity death. And so I there may be more that I'm missing because I've been so busy, but there's at least four that I think we would be remiss not to touch upon today. So, Garrett Watley, open up the Chilpack Hollywood Hour morgue, won't you?
Celebrity deaths.
The most recent one about which I heard, Dean, was that Harry Anderson died.
Yes, from Night Court. He was found dead in his apartment, as far as I remember, in South Carolina.
In South Carolina. His apartment was in South Carolina. See, yeah. I haven't even had a chance to read about this. So what do they think? Is it suspicious? Is it mysterious?
Not suspicious at all. He was 64 years old, somewhere in there, and ruled not suspicious. So
well, I find it suspicious that he was living in an apartment in South Carolina. What was going on there?
Well, he still continued to tour and do his magic act. Often, as I understood, he performed a lot in New Orleans. So that's the last I heard of his live stage show.
I guess
that was a couple of years ago.
I'm always surprised, and I guess I shouldn't be. I mean, I've told you, I love the Low Country. I love South Carolina. Love the Low Country. Love Charleston. Charleston is what I always wanted New Orleans to be like. What I, you know, what I imagined it to be like. But there's very little of New Orleans that's actually like the New Orleans that I pictured. And and Charleston gives me more of a feel of it. And I'm not knocking New Orleans. I'm just saying that Charleston is where I would go to shoot something set in New Orleans. but New Orleans is where I would go to shoot something set anywhere else, right? Because of the old tax rebates. Right. Obviously, I will learn more about the details surrounding Harry Anderson's death when Michael Bolton releases his documentary about it.
Oh, so to correct, he was actually North Carolina, Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, North Carolina.
Having moved. Yeah, he had a comedy club. I think it was called Oswald's Speakeasy, right in the French Quarter in New Orleans, where he performed for years on end. And I think after Hurricane Katrina, they sold it and moved to North Carolina.
Okay, well, that's,
if I'm not mistaken,
that now there's no excuse in it. But yes, I was very sad by this. Now, I won't admit to being a huge fan of Night Court. I mean, I vaguely recall watching it. Of course, John Larroquette was very funny, and Richard Mall, and you know, the entire cast was it was a very nice ensemble cast, and I watched it. I think is it possible it was on like Thursday nights on NBC? Was it one of their must watch TV nights or something back then?
Maybe, I think so. I wasn't watching a lot of TV then either, as I was well embroiled in theater classes and performing all around that time. So,
but when I say
don't trap me up.
Yeah, when I say I wasn't a big fan, I mean, I've never sought out reruns. I don't ever recall staying on a rerun when I slipped by it. But certainly I recall it as a funny enough show. But I was a huge Harry Anderson fan prior to that. And it even as a kid, it sort of surprised me. Wait, how does this guy get to play a judge? I mean, how does he get a show that isn't about magic or comedy? You know, it was curious to me how show business worked in that way, because of course,
right?
Yeah, I mean, his onstage persona as a magician and a comic and a con man was I don't know, I want to say it was a really cool persona, but it wasn't. What made it cool was that he was so free of that kind of affectation of being cool.
Right.
But he was just really sharp, and he seemed kind of, for lack of a better word, dangerous.
Yeah, well, there was this, because of his magic, he also had a con man sort of, you know, street magic, those street magic guys that are so breezy and easygoing, but you feel there's like something that they're tricking you out of your wallet.
They're going to rob me blind. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
That by watching this comedy special, he's going to rob me blind.
Yeah, totally. Don't know how, but you feel it coming.
But that would be the feeling I would also get watching Michael Bolton's comedy special.
Like, what if the documentary's awesome? What if it's a great documentary about Detroit?
I think monkeys will fly out of my ass. And, and off to your chiropractor, I will go. As a result, the people who are listening. Yes. There's people who are listening who might very well be Michael Bolton fans, and mm-hmm. and I get it. This is not the podcast for you. Okay, so
very good. no apologies.
Yeah. So anyway, I wish that in more recent years maybe I had the chance to go see him live, Harry Anderson.
Yeah, he had a lot of his magic. My favorite one was he showed a card trick, and then to explain how he did it, he would take his pants off and he'd show this gizmo was strapped to his leg that would hold the card, and then explain that's how he thought. Then when he pulled his pants back up, because he was wearing a pink shirt, that would be hanging out of his fly, and he'd forget to do his fly up. And then he'd just sit there with a big pink piece of cloth hanging out of his pants for the rest of the interview on the talk show. Hilarious. And not mention it, and not paint it, not point it out or anything like that. And it would just be this awkward giggles for the rest of his appearance. That's funny.
Harry Anderson dead at 64. Dean, another notable who left us. I'm hoping you can speak to his legacy and to his work a little bit. But certainly someone I remember listening to a lot, who really captured my imagination when I was a young person, loving the AM radio. I would listen to AM radio every night as a kid, well into the wee small hours. And I think it's one of the reasons why to this day I still tend to be at my most creative, you know, when daylight turns to moonlight. Anyway, Art Bell, longtime host, creator of Coast to Coast, dead at 72.
Yeah. And, what a long career he's had. He was, doing, radio back in the 70s. I remember a lot of those guys talking about his early days. And he was up particularly during the X-Files as a reference to a lot of what we referred to in the show. People would say, oh, Art Bell has already talked about this and UFOs and all that sort of thing, and had on all the guys that were even in our documentary, The Truth Is Out There, right? I mean, Art Noel and Art Noel, not Art Noel, you know, Richard Dolan. Yeah. And all the gang, and of course, Dr. Roger Lear, all those guys had been on Art Bell numerous times over the years. I think even Chris Carter was a guest on there.
Are those shows still available? Do you know?
Yeah, there is. Somebody who recorded a lot of them and put them up on his website. Now, I am remiss, but it might be the Dark Vault. You might be able to find a lot of past episodes.
I bet our friend Olav Phillips would know where those episodes could be found. Maybe I'll reach out to him and ask. Interesting, by the way, Art Bell dies. I think it was Friday. I can't remember for sure, but the night before, I was listening to Coast for the first time in a long time. Coast to Coast with George Norrie.
Oh, really?
Because a friend of mine and good breakfast clubber, who has been a guest on this podcast before, Charles A. Colombe, historian and raconteur, was a guest on it, and I quickly tuned in there late at night to Coast to Coast AM. And is there any way that you can sum up for yourself maybe the difference between in the show, if there is one, Coast to Coast with Art Bell versus Coast to Coast with George Norrie?
Well, somebody pointed out that George Norrie, great interviewer, but seems to suddenly forget his previous night's guest from his present night's guest in terms of connecting dots or having something salient to say based on what he learned the night before. Whereas Art Bell seemed to have an arc, a learning curve, that information that he gleaned, as opposed to just being an interview and filling up airtime, was that he was actually interested in this stuff. He was learning, and with the audience, learning together about all of these different, sometimes paranormal, sometimes compelling, scary, one would say. And that each guest would add to that information for Art Bell, so that it became this cumulative effect of all this, alternative information. We shan't add the word facts to it, but I think that was the major difference when George Norrie took over. It was a little more interviewee as opposed to a personal exploration.
Yeah. Okay. It did always seem to me, and that might be why Art Bell was, not just because I was younger and it captured my imagination, and there were fewer things pulling at me in terms of distraction and things that I had to do at night. You know, you go from being a young mm-hmm. person who can listen to the radio at night to being a man of a certain age who's got loads and loads of paperwork to do at night. So that's one thing. But also, yeah, Art Bell seemed to use Coast to Coast to kind of weave an ongoing story.
Right.
And you're right. And it was the story of his personal inquiry.
And then
we were riding along with. Yeah.
Yeah. And then at one point he quickly said, I have to leave the show, you know, serious things that he referred to. And I don't even know if I followed up on that one. But suddenly he left the airways under weird, suspicious paranoia of some sort. And that was the one of his many retirements.
Yeah, finally, finally came back, a couple years ago, and then almost as abruptly, after just a very short period of time, left again, and his producer, Heather Wade, took over the show.
Yeah.
So also leaving us these past few days, R. Lee Ermey, of course, who's probably, most famously remembered for playing the drill sergeant in Full Metal Jacket, though he did have certainly many other roles.
Right. But yes, he was originally, he was a Marine sergeant, wasn't he?
Well, he was a technical advisor. Yeah, he was a technical advisor on the film. And if memory serves, Kubrick was not satisfied with the actor who had been cast. And so R. Lee Ermey played the part and was brilliant. R. Lee Ermey also really alienated Kubrick. And the two men, it's safe to say, were not friends. But but that's all right. A brilliant performance. And
yeah, for sure. So it launched a career.
It really did. I mean, he did do a lot of work as an actor. Thereafter, but the career that I really want to talk about, the film career, is that of multiple Oscar-winning filmmaker Milos Forman, who died. He's going to be remembered forever for directing the Oscar-winning One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and the Oscar-winning Amadeus, both of which won many, many awards, including Best Director awards for him for both. He died at 86, and a fascinating life. He arrives in Hollywood in the late 60s, broke and lacking any English skills, but carrying a portfolio of Czechoslovakian films that were greatly admired internationally for their quirky and lighthearted spirit. And
Fireman's Ball. Did you ever see that one?
Yes. And don't those words quirky and lighthearted actually in a bizarre way apply to both Cuckoo's Nest and Amadeus?
Yeah, for sure. Oh, man. And you think about how easy it would have made that so heavy to do, you know, gothic Vienna in 17th century, and yet that movie just clips along at such a lighthearted pace. I'm talking Amadeus, of course.
He was the orphan of Holocaust victims. Interesting, you know, as was fellow emigre Roman Polanski, right? But what different tones in their work, coming from somewhat similar beginnings. He had abandoned his homeland, Forman, after communist troops invaded in 68 and crushed the brief period of political and artistic freedom that was known as the Prague Spring. In America, his record as a filmmaker was enough to get him entrance into Hollywood studios, but all his early projects were rejected, including an adaptation of Franz Kafka's novel America and a comedy starring Jimmy Durante. Think about this, in the late 60s. He wanted to make a movie with Jimmy Durante playing a wealthy bear hunter in Czechoslovakia.
oh my God, how did that not get made? I can't believe it.
When I'm disappointed. Oh, like, I would watch that. I would stop recording and watch that right now.
Totally. Okay, but if you want to see the work of Milos, how amazing that guy was, look no further than that documentary that just came out on Netflix about Man on the Moon and Jim Carrey being possessed by Andy Kaufman. You see Milos, it's not about him, but this is a documentary that they, you know, filmed in 99, the making of Man on the Moon, and how Jim Carrey never broke character. And to see Milos deal with that and still get his days covered, his footage that he needed, and still dealing seemingly without any fear or freaking out of your lead actor going, air quotes, crazy. Even Jim Carrey said, I went a little bit off because I was possessed by Andy Kaufman. Like, he truly believes he was possessed by the spirit of Andy Kaufman. And any other director would either go, hey, Mr. Carrey, knock it off, or holy shit, this whole production's gone nuts and I'm out of here. Milos somehow is steering a crazy ship and completing the project on time and on budget.
And it's not a bad film, but I think what's lacking in it probably is explained by what you're describing, because it never fully conveys how pioneering Andy Kaufman was, nor
because it shows
nor does it get into any sort of insight into why Kaufman disdained success so much. And of course, because he couldn't have those conversations with his actor, because
that's right,
because it was Andy Kaufman, and Andy Kaufman famously himself always stayed in character, right, where so many people didn't know where the act ended and where Andy began. So it is an interesting film, and that's a good story. And I think it was his next, was it his last film? It was his last film. And
well, he did something called Goya's Ghost, but
he did
Goya the painter.
Okay. Right.
Yeah,
because
Natalie Portman in it.
But before that, I mean, it's a good string. I mean, he had his first film was a flop, taking off. But he did a wonderful documentary, Visions of Eight, about the 1972 decathlon at the Olympics. And then he gets picked to do Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which becomes the first film to sweep all of the top Oscars, the top four, director, picture, actor, actress, since 1934's It Happened One Night. And that cements his career. And not all his films are fully successful or fully realized, but you know all of them. You know his adaptation of 1979's Hair. You know 1981's Ragtime, right? A lot of Oscar nominations for that.
Of course.
84's Amadeus, all the way up through like Valmont, which was an underappreciated film, but had the poor timing to be released after Dangerous Liaisons the same year. And they're both, of course, based on the same French novels. So that was a little unfortunate. And then, trying to turn Hustler magazine publisher Larry Flint into a free speech advocate in The People versus Larry Flint was perhaps an awkward attempt and felt a little anachronistic. I mean, right down to Rod Steiger playing the judge, I think it was. Unless I'm mistaken, but it really felt like a movie. This is a movie that may have had a shot in the early 70s. You know, granted, the story hadn't taken place then, but by the 90s, this was not the kind of movie that was being made anymore.
No, for sure. Yeah.
So that covers it. Except, of course, there's a couple other ladies that we'll get to later in the show. But since we're talking about movies, I want to discuss with you two. One, a second revisitation of a movie we've been discussing. But first, I want to ask you whether or not you ever did see this documentary that was Oscar nominated this year, Faces Places, about the great French filmmaker Agnès Varda touring the countryside with young street artist J.R. Have you seen this?
I've seen parts of it. I didn't go all the way through it because I know in downtown L.A. there's a couple examples of J.R.'s work, and so I find street artist documentaries to be a bit draggy. So I didn't sit through the whole thing. How is it?
Did it's fantastic. Oh my goodness! I didn't have it on my top 10, and I should have, because I saw it once and really? I saw it in theaters. But I've watched it within the last few weeks 3 or 4 times. It's one of my favorite things just to have on. And the bonus features I just love to have on, because what it really is, and it always is interesting, Dean Haglund, your knee-jerk rejection of anything that really is just like you.
Wow, that's so telling, isn't
because
it?
It's two people in a vehicle bickering, traveling around, learning the stories of people who live in different areas. That's really what it is.
Jeez, is that what I was watching? Yeah, I guess so, wasn't it?
I find this movie not only to be delightful and inspirational, but I think the reason that I underappreciated it when I first saw it some time ago and then love it now is the movie is downright healing. It really is a movie that I think a lot of people would be well served, especially in America, to watch, because it's just positively healing. It's healing for the people who are in it, but it's really healing for the viewers. And Agnès Varda, there's never been anyone like her. And the entire third act, the ending of the documentary provided by Jean-Luc Godard is otherworldly. It's one of the great endings in any movie ever. And it's thanks to her old friend, who is no longer a friend, but certainly is responsible for a great ending to a documentary, Jean-Luc Godard. So you really, you'd be well served to check it out. Now, the other movie that I want...
What does it heal, per se? That's when you say it's healing. I watch this. I can't think of...
On so many levels.
Where.
Seeing a young person and an old person and the touching nature of their friendship that develops that is independent of their ages at all. Age doesn't even enter into it. It's really two people who are learning to appreciate how the other one views the world, literally views it, because it's all about eyesight. It's also about taking the memories, the painful memories of her youth, and in some cases, redeeming them through things that are healing the places that they go and the people that they meet. It's about finding people of ethics who are living in a way that is counter, like the goat farmer who refuses to dehorn her goats. She's the only one in the entire area in France that won't have the goats dehorned. And the whole reason that she has is because she figures if they were born with horns, goats are probably supposed to have horns. And everyone else says, but you know, they become so docile. And when they don't have horns, they become so docile and they're easier to then mechanically milk. And and she points out a couple things. First of all, the milk tastes a lot better when it's not mechanically done. They enjoy it. We find it very healing. And so they're aggressive. They're goats. They're just goats being goats.
Right.
Anyway, and just how touched they are by finding these people of you know, ethics who are just living counter. They're not fighting the man. They're just living counter to the prevailing corporate wisdom. And then these two artists finding, wow, instead of putting a giant mural-sized face of someone to represent this town, let's make it be a goat with horns. And then they stood there by the goat with horns, and they told passersby why it was a goat with horns and why it was, you know, and just one by one telling people of the plight of goats. And
now I'm going to watch it again.
It's really quite special. The other movie that you still need to see and that I wanted to address, because I've been hearing some things about this that drive me a little bit nuts. But it's about how Blade Runner 2049 did not do as well as people thought at the box office because of its anti-feminist message. Is one of the things that people want to say, because of course all the women in it are they're killers or they're sex slaves or they're, you know, on and on, whatever the roles are. Never mind, of course, that what we've talked about many times before, that to depict a dehumanized society does, or a dystopic society, does not necessarily mean you are advocating a dystopic society, right? You are showing right. The danger of where we are heading, right? And so
right.
If you show a world that offers no roles for women, it doesn't necessarily mean you're celebrating the idea of a world with no... That would be anti-feminist. I, in fact, think that this right. movie is incredibly feminist, both in terms of the text... because indeed all the villains are motivated by their powerlessness to be able to do what women do. It is a world that is almost operating on a hatred of feminine power. That's the world being depicted. And
right.
What I loved was that Denis Villeneuve, the director himself, said, with all due respect to those who are defending my film, I must say that even they are getting it wrong. I am not saying that we are in danger of having 2049 be a year where there are no roles for women, you know, that are worthy of them. I'm saying we live there now.
Oh,
this
wow.
is not a good world for women. And, of course, this movie comes out right before the Weinstein shit hits the fan and really spreads into the Me Too and the Time's Up movement. But it's a movie that had a lot on its mind, similar thematically in some ways to our movie The Lady Killers. And so I just think it's unfair to paint it with the brush that it is an anti-feminist film and therefore... It failed in some ways. People look at the numbers and they say that only only 8% of the film's audience were women under 25. And to me, that is a failure of marketing, because this movie, in many ways, was designed to appeal to young women. It really has this magical fairy tale like quality to it that is, for lack of a better word, incredibly feminine. And
wow.
So I blame the company that released it. I blame the marketing materials. I don't know how you would necessarily appeal to it while still making it seem like Blade Runner. That's the nifty trick. Again, a movie Dean Haglund has not seen.
That's true, but it's on my list.
Good, good. Maybe someday we'll do just like your top 10 films that are on your list to see.
Oh, you bastard!
All right, I okay. want an update on your painting. I know you've been rehabbing so much, but But what are you painting these days? And are there any exhibits that are coming up? What's striking your fancy right now?
Well, with my fancy, I did a little weekend workshop with a local watercolorist who knew not only the names of all the paints, but if you go to her blog, Jane Simpson, she knows the number that every pigment has its own commercial number, and she writes them carefully on the little pans of watercolors. I've never seen any artist so organized as she. Anyway, Jane has her own gray called Jane's Gray, which is close to a Payne's Gray. And so I've been painting watercolors of cityscapes with these Payne's Grays and Blacks that I will be putting up on my Instagram probably later today, actually. And I'm on this sort of new tangent exploring the color gray as a single or one of two colors within the palette of a single picture. I'm also painting a commission. Our friend David Proven wants a stormtrooper kissing Wonder Woman in a large oil canvas. And there's nothing harder than you can imagine than Wonder Woman kissing a plastic helmet and to make that looking lovingly. So those are some of the challenges I'm working on. My Instagram is where you'll see it first. And working on, before I go, getting a little group show, getting a little Sydney exhibit coming up in the next couple months.
You keep dumping down into a well for some reason. Like you're laying down on top of the microphone.
No.
There's going to be a Sydney exhibit, you just said.
Yes. Yeah, group show. A couple other artists are planning something. They said, do I want to be involved? I said, absolutely. And so there we go. I'll have more information when I know more about it.
What genre of modern art would you categorize yourself as a belonging
categorize.
To?
Yeah. Is that the word, categorize?
I quote it that way because it's in the third man. But where would you categorize yourself?
Well, that's a good point. There's sort of a contemporary pop neorealism but it's also, you know, the influences of cartoons and comic books and all of that that gets recontextualized over and over again, just because what images resonate, but images that we have from our youth and who grew up watching cartoons and comic books, pretty much all of us. So that's sort of why, my instructor, Jeff Wall, said that every piece of art is somewhere in our molecule and that things resonate over the entire art history within us. So if you put in modern day pop culture references in context of historical medieval body poses or juxtapositions, you develop a whole new vocabulary in which to describe your work.
Well, obviously, people do not. I don't. The artists rarely are the ones categorizing the artwork itself, right? It's something
right.
in the zeitgeist. Yeah. There's something of an age, and we find this to be becomes a genre. It was suggested to me. And who knows how many works or what works this was based on. I have some idea, but it was suggested to me that you might fit into the genre of minimal fantasy, which is a growing and popular genre within modern art. Minimal fantasy, the term refers to an aesthetic of seeming mundanity mixed with surrealism, horror, and the uncanny. And first of all, how about the Rockwell paintings right there? Boom. There, you just nailed it. Mundanity mixed with surrealism, horror, and the uncanny. So I knew
Minimal fantasy.
Yeah, minimal fantasy. It's a great it's also the name of my my cologne for men, but
yes, there's for the ladies, there's minimal fantasy.
but I'm glad that you think that that's a possibility enough that you want to look into it more and consider it, especially seeing that the godfather of minimal fantasy is considered to be David Lynch in your face, Dean Haglund. Nobody
hoisted on my own petard. Wait, I did.
Nobody in their right mind can dispute that David Lynch's Mulholland Drive is a work of art. Fragmented geography, no frills set designs, multi-layered interpretations, the soundtrack by Badalamenti. Not to mention the complex plot revolving literally and figuratively around
Why
dreams.
Are we bringing this up?
Okay,
this
the reason. Together? Is because we're about to use your artwork to discuss what we're reading. And I am reading a publication called Back to Mulholland Drive, minimal fantasy, because this suggestion of Dean Haglund fitting into minimal fantasy made me want to learn about minimal fantasy, and all of a sudden then I find this book. It was published in French in 2017 originally, and this book studies Lynch's cult classic Mulholland Drive as a starting point for and as an influence on contemporary art. So I'm learning a lot about art and painting and different contemporary art forms. And this is one of the things you've heard me advocate so much on this show, and especially when people will write me, and they have children or students who want to become filmmakers, and what do I advise that they learn, right? And I always say, well, you should always follow what you love. You should always learn as much as you can about the movies that you love, and then you should find out about the people who made them, and you should find out about what influenced them. So it's kind of a great book for me that Mulholland Drive is being used as this entree into a contemporary art genre that I knew nothing about prior to that. So that's what I'm reading. What are you reading, Dean Haglund?
Well, I'm reading something that I've desperately needed. It's called Finding Focus in a Busy World, How to Tune Out the Noise and Work Well Under Pressure by my friend Joshua Seth, who is a who was a voiceover guy, but then got into he got a hypnotist act, a comedy hypnotist act together, and then from that, got into public speaking and corporate work, and wrote this book very much about what he was finding out there, this busy world, and how focus was so desperately needed. And so it's kind of a short book, but great, filled with lots of practical things on how to tune out and find focus, which I desperately needed, as you can imagine. With the knee operation and everything, where your focus needs to be at any given time, and a litany of projects that need to get done before we pack up this place and head back up over, as they say.
That is what we're reading. So, John Lawler, why don't you close up the Chilpack Hollywood bookshop? That's actually
is that new?
New-ish, but it's a great way to close it, actually, isn't it? I mean, I just
yeah, it sure is.
And of course, what we're reading is brought to you by the good folks at Booksmith Used Books there in Nelson, British Columbia, 338 Baker Street, Nelson, British Columbia. Booksmith, quality used books, fine purveyor of used books and all things literary. There's been something that I've wanted to discuss with you, an interesting article that I read about how there is seeming to be, at least according to the people who run these networks, there is seeming to be room within a television landscape that has been transformed by the clearinghouse approach of Netflix and Hulu, right?
Right.
That's a good word for them, is a clearinghouse.
The clearinghouse.
That there is still room within that for the curated approach to television. What there's less and less room for is something that is neither, which is kind of the old network models, right?
Kinda, but right. It's a desperate grab for the widest field.
The ever-diminishing... widest field, right? The
right.
But the curated approach that HBO and Showtime take is showing actual rewards and audience growth. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts? I thought that was a very interesting and eye-opening thing that you're
because curated growth, I mean, if you think about it, if Netflix is prepared to spend $8 billion in production this year That's some 200 and some odd series that will go at least 10 episodes each that I can't even do the math at the moment. But that works out to about 3 to 5 new television series per week that will be dumping. And what they're finding now is that you get 10 episodes, you binge watch that in approximately 1 to 2 days. So you need 3 to 5 new series every week to keep your eyeballs glued to how you've trained your demographic. Netflix, because of that, show ends and you don't even get to see the credits before the next one starts in 12 seconds. They have now basically trained the entire audience just to go through all 10 episodes within 1 to 2 evenings. So this is, you know, months of work of actors and writers and directors and showrunners and everything, putting it together so that you consume it in 2 days and you've forgotten it by the next week because 6 to 7 other TV series have come in during that time. Or, as you're saying with Twin Peaks, the revival, an extended movie, which is how a lot of these things are now seen, right? They're not just seen as a series, but they're extended movies with the beginning, middle, and end sort of thing, and your end has enough opening so that a second season can start.
And yet, whereas in the curated approach of like a Showtime, you don't make it available for binge watching because the effect is diminished if people can't savor it. You know,
exactly. Like Fargo is a perfect example. If you binge watch Fargo, you lose so many moments.
Well,
you.
I would say you're absolutely right. You take a masterpiece and you turn it into a fun show. That's what you do with Fargo a lot, right? Because the resonance is diminished. With something like Twin Peaks, I mean, I can't tell you how many people this was their experience was. You know, they couldn't wait for the new episode. Would watch the new episode. And then would spend most of the episode enraged by the episode. And then, that's it. I'm not watching it anymore. And then by the middle of the week, desperate for another episode. And that doesn't happen if they're, you know, available for binging. So it really is interesting, this idea of a curated approach. I think HBO is, we've got to say, is really... has been leading the curve in this for a long time, but they're very much at the top of the game. I remember sometimes when it seemed like has HBO's best days passed them by, but I was just flipping through. One of the things that they do that's so effective is they've got the best people, I think, at figuring out what promos to pair with what shows. I can't tell you how many times I'll rent a movie on Netflix, you know, like a theatrical release, get the disc and the previews before it. It's like, why would you think I would want this? Or I get offended because it's okay. I'm watching an art house movie. So by all means, force me to watch 15 fucking art house trailers. but HBO really knows how to do the quick drop in, show you something. And I can't tell you how many times I find myself saying, oh, that looks good. I want to watch that. Okay, that's good. And at the same time, the nature of the trailer has warmed me up a little bit. It's almost like an opening act. So I'm in the mood to laugh or I'm in the mood to be thought, you know, have my thoughts provoked or whatever it is. So that's one thing that I think they do really, really well. But it's a great time for them. I mean, John Oliver and Bill Maher are so relevant right now, right?
Yes.
That's one thing.
Right.
So they're live talk shows. Silicon Valley, the sitcom, is back. They've got a new sitcom while Veep is delayed because of Julia Louis-Dreyfus's health, struggles. But the brand new Barry, that also from Alec Berg, that they have programmed, Bill Hader as a contract killer who, following a case to Los Angeles, happens to follow his target into an acting class and falls in love with the idea of becoming an actor.
That's funny.
I had been to the point, Dean, I think we've talked about this, where if I never saw something about a hitman again and never saw anything about actors again, it would be too soon.
Right.
But the two of them combined, somehow it's perfection.
Wow. That's pretty funny. I would have never thought that pitch would have ever sold you on a trailer, I must say. This seems like something you would have clicked right over.
No, you're right. And yet, I had just heard some really good things, and so why not give it a try? And the pilot is so good. The second episode is a step back, which is often the case, right? Because we've sold the show with the pilot, and now we got to get the ball rolling. We got to get the mechanism rolling. But by episode three, it's absolutely delightful again. So yeah, definitely, I would check that out. I got an email from our loyal listener, Maurice Terenzio, who wrote me about he wasn't sure if I was a fan of Gary Shandling, which means that he certainly hasn't listened to that many episodes of the show.
Right.
But not only a fan of Gary Shandling and his work, but also, you know, Gary Shandling as a devotee of Roy London, the great acting coach, and how much I learned about Roy London through Gary Shandling. And but there's a documentary on HBO, a two-part documentary about 4.5 hours long from Judd Apatow called The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. And it focuses on how he kept diaries like all his life. And there's an opening shot in the film. It's delightful because you get to hear our friend Sully McCullough, who was filming the conversation at that point with Gary when Gary shows all his diaries. And you can hear Sully's laughter, his inimitable, unmistakable laughter beginning the documentary, which is really quite delightful. But it's a terrific documentary, and about how any form. You know, we've talked about this before. What makes an artist? What makes a genius? Is this an art form? Is it not? You know, anything that anyone does can be an art form. And this is going to sound maybe just, I don't know, ridiculous. But anything anyone does, I think, in this life can be an art form. If they're learning about themselves through it, and if they're doing it because it is, for lack of a better term, God or life, whatever it is you believe in, but if it's life's way of expressing itself through you, that thing can be an art form. And certainly, and certainly for Gary, comedy was an art form, and it's again, it's really touching. It's a very moving documentary. A very harrowing documentary at times, and another word I've been using a lot of, darn healing documentary, I must say.
Wow, seems that you are pretty injured.
Apparently, only sick people seek. This is the review I once wrote of the rock band The Cure. The headline for my review. Back when I did a little journalism, the headline for my review was "Only Hurting People Seek the Cure." Well, apparently I am the hurting people. But the point I wanted to get to, not only is it a great documentary, but HBO documentaries are just, they crush it. I mean, television documentaries are crushing it, and they're even being released as movies, right? I mean, that ESPN OJ documentary that won the Oscar for Best Documentary Feature, a 10-hour documentary. But HBO documentaries are really, I feel like that maybe they had gotten to the point where people thought they were a little passe, but they're back on top of it, and there's a two-part Elvis documentary that just dropped that I can't wait to see. It's the timing on these too. It seems like they release one every couple or few weeks, so they give you enough time to watch it. Again, this curated approach to wind it back to one of the things I think this means is to not be force feeding you to such a degree that you get stressed out feeling you've got to keep up. And if you become a viewer of HBO, you you have the time, I feel, to become aware of what's coming, what's on now, what's coming, whether it might be something you're interested in. So I always feel like I have a way to, I don't know, pace myself that isn't stressful, and I can find what I want to find.
Right. How great is that? So that's a very, I got to think, calculated thing on their part, that they have done numerous psychological studies of couch potatoes to determine how much information and how to space that out, because that doesn't seem like luck, as it were.
Well, but I don't know if you have to study it. I mean, when you know, you just have to be a student of human nature. I don't know if you need data for it necessarily. I mean, do great storytellers need that? When you go, how did you come up with something that was exactly what would resonate at this time that nobody had ever thought of? It's because I just saw that there was a lack of something, right? Or
right. And
And they're human. They must know what we all do. I mean, it is stressful. You go to Netflix, it's stressful.
Well, Netflix Australia is a bit different. We don't get the DVDs mailed to us, so we don't have that library. Basically, you open it and they go, hey, here's a new thing. You can click play and watch this new thing. So Lost in Space just showed up, and that's your big thing on the big screen, and you can hit play or you can search for whatever else you want to see. But if you just hit play on what they recommend, you generally have a new TV series every week or so.
Every 6 hours.
This week, every 6 hours. So I watched the pilot of the new Lost in Space. And, you know, might I watch another one? I don't know.
Yeah, that's been a big disappointment for people, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, you can see there's trying to lay down some brick, put down some hose, get some pipe into the ground.
My God, there's nothing. Really get... There's nothing but sex references that you're making right now, and I wouldn't have a problem with it, except you just used the word hose, and after I went on a feminist rant, I don't think you should do that.
All right.
So
I'm talking about the delivery of information.
We're over time, but I want to ask you about this idea of a curated approach. I mean, you must have seen gallery showings before where you felt that the work, not that the work could be undone, but that the impact on the audience was undone by the lack of an effective curation.
Right. Group shows that often are just whoever can mail in and put $25 down. You know, those kind of group shows that you see on Art Walk in downtown LA sometimes, very, not just disappointing, but it also diminishes the idea of going to a gallery at all. So that you think, you know, it's sort of like the 90s with Evening at the Improv, and how that just almost destroyed stand-up comedy because people said, oh yeah, I've seen stand-up on TV and it's not funny, so I stopped going to the comedy clubs. And it wasn't until that show went off the air that sort of the clubs bounced back as a thing. So,
well, you know, you have created the perfect segue out of this show, because the big rival club for the Improv was the Comedy Store. The proprietor of the Comedy Store, Mitzi Shore, died this week. And I didn't talk about her in Celebrity Deaths because she's, of course, was a major player in the lives of so many comedians, including Gary Shandling. And he talks about her in the documentary, because she always, according to him, would drop comedians into two categories. Either they really are comedians or they're writers. And that made me laugh because, of course, after I'd been at the Comedy Store performing a few times, Mitzi pulled me aside and said, why'd you cut out the material about this, this, and this? And I said, well, because that worked. And she said, excuse me? And I said, well, I was interested to see if I could take the stuff that didn't work last time and rework it and make it work. And she said, yeah, you're a writer. Writers rework things to make it work. Comedians cut out what doesn't work and stick with what does. And I said,
yeah,
well, where's the fun in that? She said, you're a writer. And it was a real eye-opener. It was great. But so then to hear that that's what she did for everyone. She would always do the quick assessment. Are they a writer or are they a performer? And
Isn't that funny?
But anyway, Mitzi Shore died. And, of course, we would be remiss if we did not mention that at 92 years of age, just a day or so after they said that they were no longer seeking treatment, but were seeking hospice care, former First Lady of the United States, Barbara Bush, died today. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have really anything other to say other than when I was watching the tributes to her. Boy, it was a different time when the Bushes were in the White House, and what a different married couple inhabited that house then than inhabit it now.
Yes, it's hard to make comparisons, isn't it?
Yeah. Even much as we would want to, and now you understand why I need healing. Okay, we're way over time. You can find every installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com, chillpackhollywood.com. We'll be back next week with another exciting installment. Until then, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Sorry again for being late this week.
Just extended the show. Intercontinental LA to Australia.
Belated spoiler alert.